Hello, and welcome to the Innovation in Financial Inclusion podcast, focusing on innovative and emerging practice in financial inclusion. I am Paul Vick from Community Finance Solutions at the University of Salford, a research unit specializing in financial inclusion and community finance. In this episode, we're going to be talking about financial education in the workplace. According to a recent survey by the Reward and Employee Benefits Association conducted for Wealth at Work, 63% of employers see poor financial literacy of workers as a key risk. 68% offer some form of financial education for their workforce. To learn more about this topic, I spoke with Jonathan Watsley and Kaylee Frost. Jonathan is a founding director at Wealth at Work, a leading financial well-being and retirement specialist. Kaylee is head of clinical support at Health Assured, which provides clinical expertise and 24/7 support services through its comprehensive employee assistance program offer. Kaylee will be sharing an employer's perspective on financial education. So, Jonathan, you work with a lot of employers across the UK around financial education. So can you start by giving us a little bit of a flavour of the type of things that employers are doing to cover issue of financial education?
Yeah, I think it's evolving, and in some ways it's constantly evolving. I mean, I could go back to the financial crisis of 2008, when I think a lot of employers started to think a lot more about how they could financially educate their staff. And that was clearly the backdrop of the financial crisis. A lot of organizations were unable to give pay rises at that time. So the question was, is what can we do for our employees to financially support them if pay is off the table? And if you kind of fast forward then to COVID, and then again to the cost of living crisis, even though the backdrops have been slightly different, a lot of the issues have been actually very similar about actually how can you ensure that employees are supported as much as possible from a financial perspective. So a lot of that ranges from everyday things, so budgeting, so how do people make their weekly or monthly pay last and cover the things that they need to cover. So thinking about things like what have they got set up on direct debits, for example? So we often see people having multiple direct debits for pretty much the same thing, but they just forget about them. The money just goes out every month and they don't think about it. So there's a bit of housekeeping to be done there, in the sense of, like, you know, understand where your money is going. And then there's bigger ticket items often, which are most people pay for. So if you think about broadband contracts, you think about mobile contracts, you think about insurances, so things like home and contents insurance or car insurance, there is still a large cohort of people that do not shop around for those things. And yet if they did, they could literally save, in a lot of cases, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pounds over a year. So It's this combination of looking at how people behave and manage their finances, and then looking more specifically around what the employer provides through their benefit offering that could also help. So one of the ones that is quite relevant right now is discount vouchers. So a large number of organisations in the UK, for example, will offer 5% off your weekly shop at, depends on what retailers they've signed up to, but, you know, Sainsbury's, Asda, whoever it might be. And yet when you look at the take up of, you know, on the basis that everybody has to go grocery shopping, when you often look at the take up of that benefit within that organization, often it's in single digit percentages. So it's those sorts of very practical things and trying to combine them to say, okay, so of course everybody would like massive pay rises, but you know, the reality is that isn't always going to happen. So what else can people do from a very practical perspective to help them?
Kaylee, can you tell me a little bit about what you are doing in your own organization?
It's like a carbon copy. Like, we are like, absolutely, if I put a mirror in front of Jonathan there, you know, like we're literally kind of on the ball, and have been for a number of years with those initiatives. again, it's quite a difficult one. As the employee, I'm still obviously an employee myself, but as the employer, it's making sure those messages are delivered correctly. You know, it would be fantastic to give pay rises every other week. It's not possible. It's not feasible as an organization to do that. But we do all of those other things that Jonathan just mentioned. So the perk scheme, I get so frustrated sometimes. I'm like, use it. I use it. And, you know, even people think that the head of department doesn't need a 5% off voucher. Absolutely, I do. You know, I use the Asda, I use the Tesco one as well. Big girly girl, use all the ASOS, all the, you know, the retail and clothing brands. And with Christmas, birthdays, all that kind of stuff, I go straight onto our perks platform. So what I try and do is wave the flag in a way that's not shoving it down people's throat or sounding self-righteous, but say, look, I just saved X amount, especially when you coincide it with brand discounts. You can use those additional discounts from the perk scheme in most instances as well. You know, we've got cash plans. We have, although we're our own EAP, you know, we're an EAP, we don't use ourselves, understandably, for our own 24/7 support. We have another EAP provider. They've got financial advisors on there that can support staff. The cash plan schemes. Cash plans tend to be really low usage. Jonathan, I'm sure you kind of see that as well from a perks perspective. It's all about raising the awareness. We've done the perks and benefit flyer, because we found that there's loads of, we've got an internal intranet and there's stuff you can click on here and stuff you can click on there. Nothing's kind of centralized because it all feeds into different areas of the business. So we've created a digital and physical handout as well, giving an average savings per year if you use, say, just three of our different perks and benefits. We also do local discounts here in Manchester, you know, for public transport. People don't make the most of those. That's why we're constantly doing benefits, mini road shows and events. People will walk past and they won't engage, and that's normal. We see it with our own clients, but the more people that can reach that we can reach with all of these different perks and benefits. But it's difficult. People fixate on the fact that the only solution is a salary increase, and that isn't going to be the answer in every solution, you know, in every scenario. So we're making all these different savings for individuals where we can as well. We do things like an annual profit share scheme as well. So whether you are in maintenance and facilities, or you are on the helpline answering those counselling calls, you will get a percentage back of our annual profit margins, which is a huge benefit there. It always, when it comes around, everyone always very much looks forward to that and has already started spending what they're going to get. So essentially it's never ending. Sorry,
this brings us to some of the potential challenges. Kayleigh mentioned the lack of engagement. I guess financial education might come across as a bit daunting and boring. Jonathan, what are some of the ways in which you can overcome that lack of engagement?
One of the key things is really segmenting down the messages and the degree to which an organization can segment down. Clearly depends on what data they have. The more data you have, the more you can segment. But if you take the highest level to begin with, then it's thinking about what are the things that the organization wants to push out, and what are the things that they're expecting the employee to effectively pull in. So we call it push and pull strategies. So a push strategy, so something that's driven by the employer, could be something like let's take the discount vouchers that Kayleigh was talking about. So it might be, actually, we're just going to have a push to all employees around the discount vouchers that are available. And maybe what we're going to do is we're going to find, you know, three or four people across the organization where we're going to run little vignettes, little case studies, if you will, about what they've done. Because we know part of the, if you like, the buyer behavior, you know, it's the you know, the classic when you go online and say, you know, people like you have done this, you know, it's building on that psychology. So if they see people in their department or their office, whatever, that kind of, if you like, look like them, they know they're on the same sort of salary range and all the rest of it, and they're there talking about how they've saved hundreds of pounds, then that can be a fantastic engagement tool. So that's a good example of a push strategy where the employer is effectively organizing it and then pushing it out. A pull strategy would be much more where the employer isn't really aware necessarily of what the issue may be with the employees. So the classic example here is debt. So the employer isn't necessarily going to know that Jane in accounts has got big debt problems or has got credit card bills that are about to spiral completely out of control. And because the employer doesn't know that, because they don't have the data around that, then that's where there needs to be pull strategies. So often that would then be around engagement of, and some of it has to be quite soft in the way it's presented. So some of it might be, might be around, ever thought about how you could lower the cost of your debt? If you want to find out, sign up to this seminar or, watch this video or whatever. And so even though it's not targeted, it's a general message, it's expecting people that are in that situation and maybe quite worried that they're going to pull on that information and then attend that seminar or watch that video or whatever it might be. And then part of that is making sure that there is good handoff. So one of the things that we always talk about is that whatever that engagement strategy is, there needs to be good handoff. So let's take debt as an example. If someone gets that message and thinks, "Oh, blimey, I'm quite worried about how my debts are rolling up, I think I'll attend that seminar." They attend that seminar, they find it really informative, but actually that it needs to get a bit more personalized, because all that seminar's done really is talk about some basic principles of how interest will compound, how credit cards are clearly more expensive than potentially other types of loans. Might give some potential solutions like credit card consolidation and interest rate free periods. So for some people that may be enough, and they go, "Oh, that's a good idea, I'll go off and do that." But if you're the person that thinks, "Blimey, the bailiffs are going to be at the door, tomorrow," that, I'm kind of way past that, then there needs to be handoff. So it's really important that there's handoff to organisations like National Debt Helpline or Step Change or Debt Charity. So that whole process needs to be completed, because what you can't do is almost dangle a solution in front of somebody, but then not allow them to execute on that solution. So I've picked on debt there as an example. There are lots of different examples for different things, but it gives you an idea as to the sort of approach that we would take.
And on that, I was scribbling down, take this away. But if an organisation has something like an EAP in place as well, they can break down. So we break down, this is not in any way, shape or form a shameless plug for our EAP, but it's just what we see. So we break down the call usage for the workplace and send them MI packs. So we break down the financial reasons as well. So we record debt related calls, housing related calls, benefits related calls, tax related calls. So within the organization, they'll be able to say, "Gosh, we've had an X amount increase in debt related calls," or how, so that could help feed into data if they have an EAP in place. And we've seen just this year alone, understandably, a 51% increase in calls related to housing, predominantly either tenants having their rent increased due to landlords' mortgage rates going up, or homeowners having their mortgage rates go up because of the interest changing. And we've had a 40% increase in debt related calls this year already, and we partner with Step Change to make those warm referrals over for if someone needs something more practical, like an actual consolidation program, a management program, or maybe even insolvency, unfortunately, and then at least they can go down that route, because we're the ones that get the people in floods of tears calling us. So they think they need to speak to a counsellor because the bailiffs have been there and they're at the wit's end, they're going to have to consider XYZ. So they think that they need to speak to a counsellor, but actually we can, they can speak to a legal advisor as well and just be grounded somewhat in the moment. And there is a light at the end of the tunnel, and then we make those kind of referrals onwards. So yeah, we kind of see that. Obviously, I see things as an employer with my own teams, but seeing it constantly every single day, these calls coming in and being able to track that usage helps us make those recommendations to workplaces as well. Like, look, you guys have had, typically we'll say you guys have had an increase in anxiety related calls or depression related calls, but now we're going, there is a housing issue within your workplace, and that could be landlords, tenant issue, it could be mortgage issues. So they could use that information more practically, like I said, to then work on these push and pull techniques as well.
So far, we have looked at the challenges, but what are some of the benefits for employers engaging in financial education?
well, we've done some research recently with employers and employees. So we were trying to get views from employers, and then we were trying to get views from employees and do a compare and contrast. So is the employer's view of the world the same as the employees, or are there gaps there in understanding? And I think some of that can really help in terms of what employers want to do or need to do, because I think sometimes it's very easy for employers to sit there and think, yeah, this is what we should be doing. But as actually, does it truly reflect the needs, if you like, of the employees? And I think then that goes to benefit provision, because as I was saying earlier, and Kaylee was saying as well, is sometimes you have benefits on offer, but there's really, really low take up. So it raises the question immediately as to, well, is the low take up of those benefits because actually those benefits are just rubbish and nobody wants them, or is it because they don't actually understand them or maybe don't know they're there or whatever? So there's almost a dissection that needs to be done up front to understand, well, are the benefits right? Are the benefits not right? So in some of this research, some of the things that were coming out, which were the employer, I suppose, trying to find solutions to what they believed were the issues that employees may have, was looking at new product. The two biggest sort of in percentage terms that came through in the research was organizations believing that they needed to put more savings products in place. Now this is quite interesting given a cost of living crisis. Kind of almost the intuitive responses were, blimey, if people have a cost of living crisis, the last thing they're going to do is afford to save. But part of the logic behind this, and I'm generalizing there a little bit because of course some people of course could save, But the logic behind it was this issue, and again, there's been lots of, not just our research, a lot of research out there about how much savings an individual has. So, for example, if they lose their job or you get an unexpected large bill, do they have the money to cover that? I'm sure different research comes out with slightly different numbers, but there's a high percentage of people that actually can only withstand about 3 months of not earning. So I think this has driven this whole notion that actually there needs to be more savings product in the workplace to try and create a pot of, if you like, rainy day money for employees. So clearly employers have pensions, which is a savings vehicle, but of course that's not much good if you're 25 or 35 or 45. So that was quite an interesting finding about actually this is a maybe a longer term approach, but should we be creating more savings products? And then the other one in the research, which is almost the polar opposite to that, was debt product. Now this is quite interesting because it is quite Marmite across organizations, and I don't know, Kaylee, how you and your organization would feel about this, but with debt product we seem to get a view from employers, which is either debt product is good because if we can organise preferential rates for individuals and therefore they're taking debt through the employer arranged facility as opposed to going out and getting payday loans or whatever it might be, where the cost of that debt would be a lot more. But then the other half of organisations kind of go, hold on a minute, I feel quite comfortable that we're almost encouraging people to take debt, and whilst it might be at a lower rate and all the rest of it, surely there's a danger that could get out of control for some people, because what we don't know is, well, is that debt going to run alongside lots of other debt that we don't know about that individual still has? So that was quite interesting as well, because there was this very split sort of view as to how good that was. And one of the subsets of that debt was salary advance. So again, Kayla, I'd be interested to see your views on this. Quite a few organisations are introducing this, and again, there's a bit of a Marmite debate about this, because some people will say, well, it's a good thing if it's earned money. So if you get paid monthly and your normal pay date is, let's say, the 28th of the month, you're waiting a long time for some of that money you've earned. So isn't it a good thing it's brought forward? But of course, there's fees attached to that salary advance. So there's an argument to say, yeah, but hold on a minute, if people are so desperate for that money, actually net-net, they're going to end up with less money because they've got to pay fees. So then you get into this debate again, okay, so what is that salary advance for? if that salary advance is because the car's broken down and you need to fix the car, and if you don't fix the car, you can't get to work, and if you can't get to work, you can't earn money, then logic would say, so maybe that's a good reason to have a salary advance. But if you're taking the salary advance every single month because you're using it to pay the grocery bills, well, you're going to have grocery bills every month. Then there's an argument to say, well, net net, you're going to end up worse off. So is that really the right approach? So if you flip that on its head and said, well, is there a more strategic approach an organization could have? And the answer to that is, well, there is. So to take my scenario of you're paid monthly, your pay date is the 28th of the month. An organization could decide, well, actually, we're going to bring forward our monthly pay date to, let's say, the 14th of the month. So effectively, you'll get in half in arrears, half in advance. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, month one, there's a cost to the organization of doing that because they're effectively bringing forward their payroll by 2 weeks. So there is a cost to it for the organization in that first month. But it's an interesting debate between the tactical and the strategic around tactically, oh yeah, I could put this little intervention in it seems to resolve an issue. But then the question is, is that really a sticking plaster? And is there something more strategic that could be done, like moving that whole payroll day? So some interesting stuff that came out of that research.
I think it's interesting that, you know, financial education is not just delivering, you know, you can't just deliver a course explaining the difference between APR and AER and those type of things. It's actually about integrating it with services and linking it up to benefits and so on. Kaylee, based on your experience as an employer, what would be your top tip for other employers?
Yeah, and aside from all the perks and things like that, I think some financial coaching from the get-go with, you know, almost like an onboarding piece. We have lots of junior roles. We hire a lot of graduates. We'd have a lot of apprentices, work placements for college. People cannot understand things like pay slips and, you know, the breakdown and things like that. So start early on. And if you can play a part in that as an employer by getting a financial coach in or something like that from the get go and just weave it into someone's onboarding process, you could make a difference as well in setting the whole education, the financial education, up for the rest of their life. I wish that was something I had at, you know, 16, 17 going into the workplace. I made terrible financial decisions and no one taught me what to do from the get go. And it's now in my 30s, I'm just, you know, kind of getting there personally. That is something that we are very keen on doing here because we have such a junior workforce as well. So we can help them budget now, but that will hopefully set them up with the right tools for, you know, forever, hopefully.
Excellent. I don't know about you, but I thought that was a really interesting discussion. I particularly liked how Jonathan and Kaylee provided some practical insights and tips about financial education in the workplace. For me, all things stood out. Number one, workplace financial education is not really a standalone activity. It sits within a wider suite of financial well-being support, including financial advice, voucher programs, cashback programs, financial coaching. And it's really a way of rewarding and supporting employees in addition to pay rises. Second thing that stood out is that it's not enough just to provide knowledge and information. You need to have a mechanism for linking those messages to pathways to action. So, for example, if you are pushing out messages around debt, make sure you have a referral process or resources to enable your employees to take action on and deal with their own debts. Third thing I took away is that it can be difficult to engage employees in financial education, but one of the useful tips is to use vignettes or case studies of employees that have taken up financial education or used some other part of the company financial well-being offer, highlighting what they did and how they benefited. And you can then use those to create and boost engagement among your other employees. The final thing I took away is a tip provided by Kaylee, which is to build financial education into the onboarding. This is especially important for junior roles, for people that may be entering employment for the first time. They may not know how to properly read the salary slip or even how the pension scheme works. And And providing some information and coaching at that stage may help them make informed decisions later on. And that's it for the Innovation in Financial Inclusion podcast with me, Paul. In the next episode, I'm going to be talking about community-based financial education with Kate McQueen from the Money Charity and Matt Johnfield from Toynbee Hall. If you want to find out more or contribute to the discussion, go to hub.salford.ac.uk/CFS or follow us on Twitter at CFS_SBS. Bye for now.